Thank you. I'm John Ackerman, an alcoholic. I am very enthusiastic about this program. I'm very grateful for this way of life. It's terrific. I'd like to thank Charlie very much for inviting me, and I'd like to thank Chris Whalen for letting me feel at home right away when I came in. I was a little late. And I love this group a lot. Most of you don't know this, but many years ago, I was 3 years sober, and I came up to the Ohio Street Tuesday night meeting for 3 years, every Tuesday. And then I got so busy down where I live in Orange County that I haven't, but I have always felt a special love for all you guys, and you are in a good place in this group. You're very fortunate. I heard Clancy when I was 2 months sober, and he was 4 years sober then, and he's one of my heroes. You probably noticed that I came in here with an entourage. When you are a known speaker in AA, many of us come in with an entourage. Mine is a little unique. They found out that I had had a stroke 2 years ago, and I didn't have any blood pressure or pulse 2 months ago. They had to pump me full with 5 pints of blood, and they just like to tell everybody that they heard me talk before I died, you know. I mean, Mike, I've known him for the last 3 years, and he has a 30-day guy with him, doing real good. And so, with this, I don't think I'm too presumptuous. I like to say this to you. Another thing that impresses me here, there's a lot of guys and girls in this group that was here when I came in and have consistently been here and showing up and helping out and carrying the message. And we grew up in AA together, and I feel wonderful to have these friends here tonight. You have never seen me before. In a very short while you will know me very intimately. And that's just one of the neat things that happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can know each other on that level. I don't think I'm too presumptuous if I say that some of us here tonight sit with a bunch of burdens and lots of if onlys. But be that as it may, we are here in these rooms are still the lucky ones because we have a chance. Lots of people have this thing called alcoholism, doesn't have a chance, and for various reasons. For the record, my grandfather died from alcoholic delirium. 1910, he lived in a 2,000-acre place off of Stockholm, but that's what happened to him. My father had a problem with his liver in 1927, and nobody knew anything about his illness then. He was a giant of a man, he radiated vitality, women adored him, men envied him, but he died 3 years later, and he only weighed 130 pounds when he died, and he didn't want to die at all, and he didn't have much of a chance. I was 8 years old then. And it is something to see a beautiful human being like he once was. Because he was 6'2", and when he touched you, you realized his strength. But in 3 years, he had deteriorated to absolutely nothingness. My father was an aristocrat. He was vain and proud and arrogant. But he was also a very loving person. But I wasn't violent. And thanks to our program, I have been able to forgive him for that violence. And it's an important point. 99 out of 100 meetings I go to, we finish with the Lord's Prayer. And there's a line that says, "Forgiven as I forgive those who trespass against me." And I can assure you that all the stuff in my inventory I wish I could be forgiven about. And then we can't have two stand-ups here. I'm supposed to be forgiven. I'm supposed to have an opportunity for a new life. But anybody that did something to me, justice for them, or whatever you want to call it, it's an important point, because if we don't address this issue, we will come in as victims and we will remain victims, and it will interfere in our own recovery. And that's why I bring up that point. My older brother didn't have much of a chance for another reason. He had a little bit of pride, and it seems to be a commodity that we can't afford a luxury in this office. 20 years ago now, he lived in a castle outside Stockholm. He was married to a very beautiful girl. In fact, he married my girlfriend. I had a little bit of problem with that for a while. Now I'm glad he did. But he drank like I drank, and he blew it all. For 18 years he defended his right to drink. It is something to see this insidious denial that some of us have, you know. He earned $150,000 a year, spoke 6 languages fluently, carried a Swedish flag in the Olympics on 3 occasions. For 18 years he lived in a room that cost $15 a month to live in, drank a fifth of whiskey every night, and just lived in the passion of us. Nothing ever wrong with him. I tried to 12-step him a few times. His drunk alone and mine was very similar. I wrote him a letter, a page and a half what I used to be like, 3.5 pages about all the wonders that has happened to me since I joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a postcard back. Dear John, I'm sorry to hear about all your problems. So much for identification. I flew to Stockholm in 1978 and spent a couple of weeks with him. I invited him here to this country. He was here with me for a month. I took him to AA meetings. He died 9.5 years ago from yellow jaundice. My younger brother has gone through scripts in La Jolla twice. The first time was 17 years ago. And they told him that he couldn't drink alcohol anymore. There was something really wrong with his liver, and he shouldn't drink booze anymore. He doesn't drink the way I do, and that's all what he is looking at it. He has kind of 6-7 whiskeys before dinner, 2 kinds of wine, coffee and brandy for dessert. It's kind of elegant. He even lights a couple of candles now and then. It's all bullshit. You know, he's still drinking. And sometimes you and I wonder, what's wrong with people like my brothers? Nothing is wrong with them. Alcohol did something for my older brother to the day he died. It's still doing something for my younger brother. And that's the nature of the illness. And that's why I said in the beginning, you and I are the lucky ones because of the evidences in these rooms. Like people like you and I, the way we drank and carried on, we can change and live without and have fabulous lives. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, how to live without and without it. I talk to newcomers. I love the feelings in these rooms with our newcomers, and I like being a newcomer myself. It's very important to me. And I like to share with you why I like to be a newcomer. I hope I never forget the last year I drank, because I compromised on everything I believed in and stood for. I couldn't live or function without liquor. I didn't dare to go to sleep if I didn't have a fifth of whiskey in the refrigerator, because I had to have it when I woke up. And if I ran out of booze at midnight, I usually called an associate of mine in Baldwin Park and said, "Well, next week you'll loan me $150 from this particular job. But if you give me $20 tonight, you won't have to pay me the $130 next week." And I go the 100-mile round trip at midnight to pick up $20. I didn't dare to buy any booze in Baldwin Park because then I wouldn't make it home. And when I came home to Anaheim, where we lived at the time, I bought a fifth of Imperial Bourbon for $4.85. And then I was safe, and I had to leave like that, and I hope I never forget that period in my life. I know some of us, after we get a little well, get a few dollars in our pockets and bedroom privileges again, we forget how it really was. In fact, my wife cut me off 6 months before I came into AA. She really ran out of humor at the end, I tell you. She stood out left to me one evening and said, "John, I wish you could find yourself a girlfriend so I wouldn't have to fool with you." She said, "You take forever." Thank you. After sobriety you take forever, it's very commendable. The other reason why I like to be with them, I've been going to meetings every day for 90 days and feel petty talk on Sunday morning, And he stood up here and said, if you keep going to meetings, you will wake up one morning and realize and find out that you can function without alcohol. And it is not necessary to drink anymore, and you have a way to go. And I sat in the room and I said, my God, I've experienced those feelings. And it was the first time here it dawned on me that I wasn't hooked anymore, that I had some degree of choice over my own actions. I had already started to experience a freedom here that I hadn't had for a long, long time. And I hope I never forget that period in Alcoholics Anonymous. The knowledge that I wasn't hooked and that I was free, and I hope I never take it for granted. Those are the two reasons why I like to be a newcomer. I didn't start to drink until I was 31 years old, you know. Doesn't sound particularly promising, right? But that's how it was. But I'll tell you where I was when I was young. First of all, the reason why I didn't drink when I was young. When my father died, I promised my grandmother I was never going to drink, so I didn't drink. When I was 19 years old, I'd gone to college a year. The war broke out. I went in the Air Force for 2.5 years. And after that, I went back to college for 1.5 years, and I was sailing at night, and I was trying to help my mom. It was important to me to play the man at the horse park because my older brother was different. He was brilliant in school. He had scholarships to universities, and everything was mapped out for him. But I was different. And I could never figure him and me out in the first place. You know, this fella, he never opened a book. He had A's in everything. I could study at 1 in the morning. I still failed. It really bothered me. It's still bothering me. Sharon, I did it. You know, she was so nervous I was going to use the other word. You know, when I was young, I had an unbelievable inferiority complex. I'm a perfectionist and top of it, and that's not a good combination. I contemplated suicide a lot because I knew if I died, I would be my dad. And you see, he knew that was security, prestige, and respect, and those things. And I tell you what I did when I was young. I just faked it. I pretended I was really together. I was very noisy and opinionated, and that gave me some false courage. And that's how I was when I was young. When I was 31 years old, I was employed by this door factory in Alhambra. My boss was alcoholic, and he taught me how to drink every day. And I tell you, I don't have time to drink all that stuff, but we drank a fifth a day, fifth of booze a day from day one. For 2 years, I was never drunk, never hungover. I just felt good. And it was an incredible vehicle for me, you know. And a year later, I owned the place. I had sold so many doors, they couldn't pay me my commission, so they gave me 1/3 of the stock of the company. And I was really a success story. I mean, you know, I had just been here a few years, and I owned part of a door factory. It was really something else, you know. And it was a wonderful time in my life. 8 years later, they fired me from my own door factory. You know, it was, I had 3 beautiful girls and a son, and we took them to church on Sundays. We did everything right with the Americans. The only problem with that church business, the last 4 years I drank, I was a Mormon drinker. She usually inspected me before we should leave, and many times she just took one look at me and said, not today. Hurt my feelings when she took off down the street with the kids in the car, and I had to stand in the corner at home. Sometimes I ran down the block after her, screaming and hollering, and my neighbors were outside talking about the lawn problem, and here I came running by, and sometimes I was strangely clad. She saw me coming running after on my pajamas, you know. She stopped down the block and waited for me and rolled down the window and said, what's the matter now, you know? And I said, don't forget to pray for me, you know what I mean? And then, when I got there, I didn't feel like I belonged, but Jesus, I cried, you know. I sat down, looked sincere, and hummed a lot. I could take the sermon 20 minutes max, and then I had to have a drink. 20 minutes into his talk, I said, I'll screw them all, you know what I mean. And then I went home, and I drank Grand Scotch those days and played good music and became very spiritual. Played Stan Getz and Dave Brubeck and LaBoheme and Coleman Hawkins and the big bands. Sobriety, I even played Pink Floyd and Brian Ferry. I don't know what happened. It progressed after that. I mean, a couple of years later, I sat in the Episcopalian Church in Anaheim on the floor, sang all by myself, you know. I never had a problem with my alcohol until I tried to stop drinking. One week my wife says to me, you know, you drink too much. I said, what are you talking about? You drink way too much booze, Junior. I said, well, then I quit, and then I couldn't quit, and that's when it all began. When I was into my drinking 2-3 years, I was up to 2 fifths of whiskey a day. The last year I drank, the last 10 months I drank, it didn't matter if I drank a pint or 3 fifths of whiskey a day. I also drank 2 bottles of codeine cough medicine every day, 6 anacins 4 times a day. I was absolutely weird. Those 10 months I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober, and the guilt was on all the time, and I was no relief, and I just thought I was going crazy, and I probably was. And this is a terrifying time in our life, because we can't tell nobody. I was just afraid they were going to find out I lived. I know they were going to put me away somewhere. And sometimes you and I, we talk about the alcoholic loneliness. As far as I'm concerned, I ain't nothing like it. Because it is a total isolation. And we drink to live, and we know we are dying. There's no way out of it. And that's how it is. 2 years after the shakes began, little things happened to me when I stopped drinking. One morning at 4 o'clock, I sat in my bed, straight up, and looked in front of me. This big white snake came out of the wall. You know, I never saw anything like it in my life, unbelievable. It came right out of the wall. It was snow white, had 3 black eyes. This big diameter, 23 feet long. He came slowly across the room, stopped right in front of my face, and started to hiss at me. Like this tongue dangling, you know. I could even smell it. Kind of a paraldehyde, sweet mortality, the whole thing was incredible. And I sat down and said to myself, you know, I haven't had a drink for 3 days, so it can't be the booze. The closer he came, the more I screamed, and the noise in my head from my own screams reached such a crescendo it was eventually like my brain exploded from my own sound. He finally said, and then I blacked out and fell backwards. That was my experience with it. My wife told me in the morning, she said, something strange happened this morning around 4 o'clock. She said, you sat straight up, looked in front of me for quite a while, and then you said, one night I made love to her, and she wasn't even there. All right, I'll pass. And anyhow, we went through a lot in alcohol. And you know, finally, I couldn't function at all without. I mean, I could not. It was an absolute impossibility. I couldn't answer the phone without having a drink first. I was an alcoholic at the end of it. I used to say I'd go down and buy a loaf of bread and a fifth of milk, you know. The last 4 years I drank, there wasn't anything I didn't try to use to stop. Sworn the Bible, it was very important to me. I went to a minister for counseling every week for an hour for 18 months. When he wouldn't talk to me anymore, I went to, and he said yes to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what he was talking about. I went to a psychologist in Santa Ana. I spent $2,000 with this doctor. That wasn't anything he said to me, You know that doctor there, like I said, that wasn't anything he said to me that my wife didn't tell me for free 3 times a day. That wasn't anything he said to me either that wasn't the truth. One time he stood down and looked at me and said, you know what's wrong with you? And I said, tell me. And he told it all my secrets and all my emotional problems. And I said, you doc, that's it. You're absolutely right about all that. And that's why I drink. Because I can't stand myself the way I'm put together either. So then he laid on me, I hurt my wife and my kids with my drinking. So what do you do then? You do what I did. I went on the wagon. And the tragedy with that, at this stage of the deal, is simply this. The more sober we become, the more we realize that we hurt our loved ones. And that in itself drives us back to drinking again. Because that's the only way we know to get out from under the guilt. And so it is. There's a lot of capable people in the field of alcoholism today, but I sure don't envy them, because the nature of the illness is still the same today as when I came in. As long as alcohol is doing something for us, it's impossible for anybody talking out of using it, and that's the nature of the illness. And that again was why you and I are the lucky ones, because of the evidence that's in these rooms. You know, I just like to tell you how alcoholic I was at the end. My wife had a suicide attempt in Palm Springs one time because she didn't thought I loved her anymore and wanted out of it. And that wasn't so at all. One night I was really drunk, and she said, do you do this to drive me crazy, or don't you love me at all anymore? I said, I thought it was the other way around. I thought you didn't love me. So then we talked our hearts out. We talked to each other for an hour. When we went to bed, we were like happy kids, and I knew everything was going to be all right. The next morning, she waved goodbye to me, and I should drive out. I had an appointment around 11 o'clock. She left home around 8:30 or something like that, and she waved goodbye, and I said, Jesus Christ, she still loves me, and I'm going to be all right. 9:30 around there, my shakes began. And I had this appointment with Teach Construction, a big developer. So I went into my little bar down in Gilbert at Catella and had two double shots of whiskey to stop the shakes. Went in and saw Mr. Teach, negotiated a contract for 110 homes in Oceanside, and I came out of there, and then the compulsion was on, and I just went in and got drunker than hell and came home, and my wife met me at the front door. I knew you didn't mean it, you son of a bitch, you know. And I mean, that's alcoholism. That's how it is. We can't help it at that time of our lives. That's how it is. And I was picked up at trying to steal a pint of liquor. Pretty much Sunday morning. I couldn't even defend myself. I just stood on the wing for the tent in me. I mean, look where I came from. And I was brought up in a beautiful family in the most favorable circumstances. But that morning in Anaheim, I looked exactly like a person who has to steal a pint of liquor to live. And that's where I was in my life. Then came that last episode when my wife said to me, you know, the last ultimatum, and said, you know, Johnny, for years, because of the children, we have stayed together, but not because of them, we have to part. And either you go down and try that thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to leave again. And that's the only reason how I came into the Alona Club in Anaheim. I didn't want to be kicked out again. I came in there, and Josephine behind the coffee bar said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, no. Get along this famously with her. Can you do something for my wife? She's crazy. And that's how it is, and we don't know if this is going to work or we got to cover our own bases. I'll tell you another thing. If I had known how sick I was when I came in, I would never have stayed. Stopping drinking wouldn't have fixed that. And I think this is one of the most merciful things that God has in store for us right up front, because many of you and I, if we had known how bad it was when we came in, we would have done something much more drastic. But I said, line in the big book that covers us will always be revealed. Thank God for that line. And I'll tell you another thing. When I came in there, alcohol was not my problem. It had been my solution for so long, and we so slowly and so gradually go into our relationship to liquor, it's impossible for us to see why. Well, we are in relationship to liquor and we need it because for a long time it worked. And that's part of the insanity here. It might work like it used to. And that's what we're all shooting for. By the grace of God, and it all happened to me the next day. I woke up in the morning, I went out in the kitchen and drank a little codeine cough medicine and two shots of whiskey and brushed my teeth. Drove down to the Alona Club in Anaheim and polished off a pint of Seagram 7 on my way down there. Yeah. Came in there and asked them, call my wife and tell her I'm here already. And I stood on bullshit a little bit, and then I went out and had four double martinis for lunch. Came back to the club and asked her, please call my wife again and say I'm here for the second time, you know. And then I should go home and buy a feast to say I've been to AA three times that day. And this guy standing at the coffee bar, and he just stood down and looked at me and said, Johnny, why don't you come home with me and let us talk? And I said, okay. I don't know. His name was Charlie Vick. He became my sponsor. And we sat in his patio and he told me his story. And that's what I think is important in Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk talking to another. And the identification between the two. And when he was through with his story, I realized that he was worse than I was, and he depended more than I did on it, and he was sober. And I said, you were that bad and you can stay off the sauce? And he said, yes. And I knew he was telling the truth. But I tried to wriggle out of it one more time. I said, Charlie, you don't understand. Every time I stop drinking, I get the shakes. And weird things happens to me when I stop drinking. And he said, Johnny, you will only shake for 4 or 5 days. Then you never have to shake again as long as you live. And I didn't know that. I sat down and I thought, Jesus, what information this guy is coming up with here, you know. Then he told me about the disease of alcoholism. He called it an allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And he said, the first thing is a mental one to make you comfortable. And then the body takes over and creates more booze, and you cannot control your thinking pattern or your behavior pattern. So things made a little bit of sense to me that morning, that afternoon. I was in a meeting that night, and when the red portion of chapter 5 that we heard here this evening, I just said, please God help me today to stay sober. And it wasn't a big deal. You know, I always thought the spiritual experience would be something like, kaboom, yes, John, what can I do for you, you know. But it wasn't like that at all. It was merely a feeling. And my thoughts were these, that perhaps after all this takes away for me too. When I came home that night, I said to my wife, I said, you know, it happened to me tonight. I don't have to drink anymore. She said, your eyes look different. I haven't had a drink of alcohol or any codeine, cough medicine, or strange pills or funny cigarettes since that day. It's 31 years and 10 months and 17 days ago now. And you all knew you might sit down and say to yourself, well, it must be easy for you to have all the time on the program, but it wasn't easy then, and that's what we are dealing with right now. You know, I was not a great success when I came in here. I had a lot of anxieties about my kids. I wanted to be a good father. I knew I wasn't most of the time. It was $36,000 in the hole, and they were all small bills and due, and my wife's suicide attempt just about drove me crazy. It's very hard to live with yourself when you realize that you are broken another human being's spirit. But I didn't drink and I went to meetings. And that's all I had going for me for quite a while. But I just like to tell you all new here tonight that those first 2 months of my sobriety, I had the most unbelievable fears. I couldn't handle nothing. When the phone rang at home, I just pointed at it. I said, I escaped and hid in my closet and sat down on the floor. I was so scared to death about it. I had about 10 days of sobriety. I sat in the front row in the stag meeting and blurted out. I said, you guys don't understand, but I feel so damn guilty. And that was an old timer said, the reason you feel so guilty is because you're guilty. And there were guys like that that saved my life. And for the first time I could admit it was my fault through observation. As long as you pin it on somebody else or something else, nothing can happen to us. But I just came to the conclusion, whatever they had done or she had done or said, I drove them to it. And when I took it on that basis, I was free. But when that meeting closed that night, it was probably the most crucial time for me here, because I felt trapped. I felt I was in a corner I couldn't get out of. I actually regretted that I had cupped out in the mirror. It was my fault. The only thing I had going for me here then was this, that I knew under no circumstances could I go back to drinking again. No matter what, I couldn't escape the booze anymore. I had done enough damage, I had no more rights when it came to liquor, and whatever was coming my way, I just had to face the music. But I couldn't split the booze anymore. So I'd actually taken the first 2 steps in this program and didn't know it. But how do you turn your real life over to the care of God, if you understand Him? What's the spiritual experience in these rooms? Well, that happened to me moments later the same evening. As I stood all alone and afraid, this guy came up to me. I never saw him before. And he just came over and put his arm around me and said, Johnny, don't worry, everything is going to be all right. And I believed him. And that's how it began for me with higher power. It was just like those guys had my welfare talk, and I just trusted them. For quite a while, those same guys actually gave me the courage to face my wrongs and my difficulties. And they talked to me in a fashion I never experienced before, because they didn't point fingers and there was no judgment. They just shared their own experiences from heart to heart. And this love and this care that goes on in this room is really the most healing commodity that we can offer being offered. It suits us back to good health, and it gives us a God of our very own that we can trust on any condition. It's here for everybody. Nobody is excluded. My wife didn't believe I was going to stay sober when I came in. It took 2 years of sobriety before she realized I meant business. And you know, we are sensitive when we come in and we want them to believe us. But for one reason or another, I also understood this. She didn't dare to believe it. Every time that I had been on the wagon and every time we became friends, I always went back to drinking. So I realized that she didn't dare to believe it. And besides that, A lot of stuff is going in only these rooms for us. We come in here, you're doing this fine, and you're paying in down. It's going to get better. Don't worry about it. And we have this whole support group here, so we don't have to go through nothing alone anymore. And you see, when it comes to trust, it's nothing we can demand. It's something we have to earn. And that's what the day of the time is all about. Now, I have 2 months of sobriety. Charlie comes and says, you know, sobriety got to be the number one in your life. I said, no, my kids come first. I love them all my own life. And he says, you know, without sobriety, you won't have them. You have a letter in your pocket to prove it, which was true. And then I said, yeah, my business, I got to pay them bills. He said, you know, you rank up a door factory or 36th thing in the hole. If you don't stay sober, you're going to blow this thing too. And every but I came up and he plugged it. And I realized it's true. Without sobriety, I don't have a chance at all. And then there's no condition on sobriety, he said. I said, what do you mean no conditions? If he could forgive me, my job could go start again a little bit, I could consider this damn thing. No condition on sobriety, because one of the conditions you set up might not come through, and then you blame AA for it and go out and drink again. And for one reason or another, I bought the package. And then something spiritual can happen to us here. But if I tell you how it was in my house, you know, I got up in the morning, my wife would say, before I had a bruise, it's a crutch. And I had those damn meetings. I was that kind of a weakling that can't stand on your own 2 feet. I said, I suppose so. And then I go out and I work all day. I come home a little before dinner. 25 phone calls about all the people who wanted to get paid that I couldn't make commitments to. You know, it was just terrifying, all these phone calls. And then I had a quick bite to eat. And then I ran to a meeting, and I had a reprieve here for an hour and a half. And then I should go home and thank God for my sobriety that day. I said, God, what a terrible day I've had. What an absolutely terrifying day I've had. I said, yeah, but I didn't drink. I said, what's going on here? I used to get drunk over a lot less. And then it begins, because then I realized that this thing called sobriety is mine. My own. It's the only decent thing that has happened to me in a long time. It must be some sort of a gift or something. And then we start to have a consistency in our living, and then we add to it. And then everything is God's business from now on, good and bad. And if he's part of the bad stuff, the bad stuff might just be a period within a period. And when you're going through that period, you realize that you had to go through it. And then it all starts to make sense to us. And I, you know, again, so this thing with sobriety, that's the big deal here. When many people say, when will my ship come in? This is the ship. And then this admission and the acceptance of this thing is part of that gift. It says in chapter 3 we have to conceive. Telling them ourselves we are alcoholics, that's the first step of recovery. You know, this, the admission and the acceptance is part of that gift of God, as far as I'm concerned. Those three things is a divine intervention. Because 9 out of 10 alcoholics never make it because they don't buy what I'm talking about. 9 out of 10 alcoholics either die of a crazy from New Zealand because they don't buy what I'm talking about. 9 out of 10 alcoholics have periods of sobriety, but in and out of treatment centers, in and out of care units, in and out of meetings of alcoholics now, because they don't buy what I'm talking about. So this is a big deal. And then, now we hear alcoholics, addicts, what's the difference? You know, an heroin addict doesn't identify with somebody on coke. The people on coke, they feel superior to alcoholics for one reason or another. Suppose it's the price tag as a snob appeal or something. Now, many of them say, if I had a program like Alcoholics Anonymous, it would be great. Narcotics Anonymous, Coke Anonymous have a lot of credibility today, have a lot of success stories, have a lot of consistency in being clean. But what's wrong with us? 9 out of 10 of us don't make it. What is our art? It's like Clancy says, my case is different, you know. And I'll tell you something. When I realized this, that this is it, This is my big deal here. I tell you, I felt special. I really did. I felt like I was a God's kid, and we all are, as far as that is concerned. But you know this thing that I felt special, it has nothing to do with an ego whatsoever. It was a moment of clarity or spiritual experience because, for this reason, why did I see it? Not even my brothers. How many people have you and I crossed that over the years that don't want it? This is something very special that I'm talking about. And you know, again, about addicts, alcoholics, what's the difference? An addict is trying to get out of reality. We are trying to fit into reality. The recovery program is the same. Total abstinence in the 12 steps of the program. And now my sobriety is right. My AA life is good. My work starts to go better. I come home after work and my kids say, "Hi, Dad, can we talk?" Not a kid's own place. And I tell you something, every day we stay sober, our life gets better. That's something we recognize that we can be grateful about. Like the young lady that spoke here tonight about her sobriety. You know, sometimes it is like this, that you and I don't drink is the only thing that's right in our lives. And I tell you another thing, it's worthwhile to fight for sobriety. And then I had 2 years of sobriety. My wife comes to me one day and says, "Johnny, it wasn't there, it was your fault." I said, "Now I can die." Well, now that is in place. Long ago now, she said, "You know, this life we live today is really the most fabulous adventure." And it was so hopeless and tragic at one time, completely turned around. There's even a degree of innocence between us today. And that's impossible to believe, but that comes to be because she's just as busy in Ireland as I'm in AA. And we have seen so many people over the years that turn around and start to be good to one another. Nothing is in vain. All that bad stuff is going to benefit somebody else down the line. You know, seems like I have only 5 minutes left here, but I just like to tell you that my daughter, my youngest daughter, Katrina, she had the same personality as me. 28th of July this year, she had 10 years of sobriety. And her husband has 20 years of sobriety. He lived up in Montana, you know. My son was hooked on pot and rocks for 4 years when he went to Laguna Beach High School. He has been off that stuff for 15 years, May this year. And he's a beautiful guy and doing really well. We are so grateful for our lives. Now, I like to polish this thing off a little bit. You know, the 12 steps for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the recovery program, but it takes a while before it falls in place. And in the meantime, the group and the fellowship in these rooms is of the greatest importance. I love in the beginning of the book where it says, "Alcohol is a mere symptom of something deep-seated emotional. It sure covers me." I love in the beginning of the book where it says, "God, as I understand him, it must be the most spiritual line on the face of this earth that has ever been written." Think about a line that doesn't interfere in anybody's religion. It's an incredible thing. I love in the beginning of the book where it says, "We are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body." Recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. What a promise. But again, the fellowship and the good. Will you turn off this light, please? I promise you I'll get off as soon as I can, okay? Thank you. That was a guy coming in Anaheim that I'm sharing about how important the group is. His name was Bill Schellenberger. He was a framing contractor. And we became Bill's friends. And he was framing 110 houses for Mr. Wilson. Albert Wilson, a developer of my way, built about 1,000 homes a year. Was 72 years old, this guy. Built about 1,000 homes a year. But Bill is framing 110 houses for Mr. Wilson in Mission Viejo. It was in July and it was 84 degrees hot. I came out Friday afternoon to see what my guys were doing. And Bill is up on the second floor nailing on roof rafters. And he looked pretty good. He was 6'2" and red handkerchief around his forehead, no t-shirt, shorts on, a big belt, big hammer, 30-foot tape and construction boots, and looked pretty much up there when he was swinging the hammer. He saw me coming down the street. And just then, Mr. Wilson, the 6th vice president, came down to cul-de-sac in a three-piece suit, but Dick saw me. And he said, "Joe!" Took one step off down from the second floor, bounced right down there and did it and flew right up again like nothing, threw himself around me and kissed me twice. You know, here we are, two big guys in the construction job. Wow, Jesus Christ, you know. And we started hugging each other, you know. And Mr. Wilson stood down looking at us. He said, "What's going on with you guys?" He said, "Oh, Mr. Wilson, old John and I went to Alcatraz together." He knew better. He stood down and looked at me and said, "No, I don't think so. But whatever it is, it's beautiful." And that's what's going on here. The room, the group, the fellowship, they will care us when we can't care for ourselves. Chuck Chamberlain, all the years he lived amongst us, trying to show us what's going on in these rooms. It's called love with no conditions. Love with no conditions. You and I can be who we are and what we are, and in spite of we are loved. There's nothing like it as this love with no conditions. And then this ism we have. It makes us belong. We belong to each other. There's a sense of belonging in these rooms that is absolutely haunting. It's a pact of reality. Alone we cannot do it. Together we can. The room, the group, the fellowship, it cares when we can't care for ourselves. When I was 13 years old, I used to sit and look out over the ocean in Sweden. And I had intentions and anticipations and dreams. I'm 72 years old now, and I look out over the ocean in Laguna Beach every day. And I have intentions and anticipations and dreams. And I'm extremely vulnerable. And I thank God every day for that sensitiveness that you and I have. That sensitivity that I used to curse. What's the matter with me? Why do I ever feel in all directions? That sensitive part of it will become a blessing because it will function like a thermostat and it will motivate us to take the action that's laid out in the program of Alcoholics Now. The action we take sets us free. Chuck used to say you can't think yourself into good living. You have to lead yourself into good thinking. It's the action we take that sets us free. But Chuck said another thing. He said, life is tough and life gives us blows. And even in longevity on this program, we can sometimes get into the negative. And even fear. And that has to do with the distance from God we are. But he said, self is involved here. It's actually a conscious separation from God. And conscious implies that I have something to do about that. And now again, the action I take sets me free. You all knew. If you can just believe this, that we only wish you well and we only want good things for you. If you can just believe that and take that with you, you will never wake up lonely anymore because you know by now there's a way to go and to live. I cannot for a moment believe that God would take us through all these things and bring us in here and show us this way to live if he didn't have any plans for us. It really wouldn't make any sense at all. So you all know, do this. Do what we do. Don't drink and come to meetings. It's the best deal in town. Thank you.